Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm joined today by my colleagues Michael Meiden, who's Director of Gas and China Programmes, and James Henderson, who's Director of the Energy Transition Programme at the OIES. Now, as you're all aware, during the month of October 2022, we published 5 podcasts, including 14 interviews on issues and challenges facing the forthcoming COP27 conference that, of course, is being held in Sharm el-Sheikh 6th to 18th of November. Now, in this, the last of our pre-COP27 podcast series, we're going to try to summarise some of the key points that have come out from the earlier podcasts and specifically address China in a bit more detail. Now, just to timestamp this recording, in the ever-changing world that we live, we are recording this podcast on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 26th of October, 2022. Michael and Jim, welcome back to the OIS podcast series. Well, Jim, can I start with you? You know, perhaps quite a basic question, but one that certainly really has come to mind in our last 5 COP podcasts. You know, what will be the main issues to be discussed at COP27?
Well, I think it's obviously being held in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, and the Egyptian presidency has set 4 main goals around mitigation, adaptation, finance, and collaboration. And what that means in practice is, in terms of mitigation, it's reviewing the pledges that were made ahead of COP26 and any updates since then and whether any progress has been made. And the Egyptian presidency wants to focus on implementation of those pledges. So has there been any progress on implementation? On adaptation, this is one of the key issues for the developing world. Focus on preparing the world for significant climate change impacts. And so, is money being offered for that? What progress has been made there? Finance is going to be a big issue, particularly for developing world countries who are looking for the developed world to provide finance to help them implement the energy transition and prepare for any climate change impacts, and also to pay for loss and damage, which we might talk about later. And then in terms of collaboration, the Egyptians are very keen to encourage kind of global consensus and bring countries together, which might be difficult at these times of geopolitical stress, but it's certainly a goal. So that's the Egyptian presidency. I mean, I think in terms of overall, we will be reviewing some of the pledges that were made at COP26 to see what progress has been made on those. We will be preparing for the global stock take, which is due to take place in 2023, and which is going to, again, review the progress of the world towards meeting climate targets. And the other key will be to see whether any new pledges, any higher ambition can be reached among the countries that are present at the COP.
So, Jim, you know, which issues do you think are going to be the most likely to be most contentious?
Well, the most contentious will almost certainly be the question of financing. This is an area where the developing world countries, the G77 and beyond, have basically argued that the developed world has caused the climate problem by emitting significant amounts of CO2 since the Industrial Revolution. The developing world contains the 3.5 billion people who are likely to be most affected by climate change caused by high emissions. And therefore, there is a moral obligation as well as a kind of commercial obligation, if you like, for the developed world to fund change in the developing world, and that change to cover the developing world investing in mitigation technologies, so renewable energy, etc., investing in adaptation to prepare for the impacts of climate change, and most controversially, paying loss and damage money, if you like, payments for damage already incurred in the developing world by climate change. So I think this is going to be pretty controversial stuff and has been brought up at a number of meetings between COP26 and COP27 and has already created some tension. So I think that'll be a big area. I think the other area that the developing world will focus on, and this COP has been framed as the African COP, the COP for the Global South, so it really is going to focus on issues that Global South countries find important, is the 2 IPCC reports that were published earlier this year in February and March, which focused on the impacts of climate change and what we can do about mitigation. And it highlighted that really developing world countries are going to be the hardest hit and are going to be hit pretty hard if temperatures rise above 1.5 degrees post-industrial revolution levels. And also that it's going to be increasingly difficult for us to keep to those temperature targets. And I think there's going to be a focus on saying, look, we've been told the problem is coming around the corner. We're not doing enough. What are we going to do about it? What are you, the developed world, going to do about it? Because this is a problem really created by you. And so there'll be a very intense look at the nationally determined contributions, the ambition of developed countries to, one, solve their own emissions problems, but two, to help everyone else, the developing countries, solve their problems too. Beyond that, I think there'll be a focus on US and China. Will the two largest emitters be able to come together in some kind of collaborative way and talk about what they can do together? And there'll also be kind of conversations around the other multilateral pledges and questions asked around whether people are really keeping to commitments around, for example, global methane emissions, around deforestation. And I think that, again, could be somewhat contentious.
Jim, you mentioned COP26 a few minutes ago, and I just wanted to ask you, has there been much progress on some of the key pledges made in Glasgow last year?
I think the overall answer to that is unfortunately no, for the very obvious reason that many people, politicians particularly, and policymakers have been distracted by geopolitical events. So, of course, first we had in February the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Since then, we've also had kind of controversy around Taiwan with Nancy Pelosi's visit from the US and the Chinese reaction to that and the breaking off of relationships between China and the US, and that sort of focus on whether that's another boiling point about to sort of tip over into more active confrontation. So there has been distractions, and clearly there's been a cost of living crisis, very, very high energy prices, so lots of other distractions. So unfortunately, I think the answer to most is no. You know, if I want to pick out one highlight of a sort of plus point, I'd probably say the zero emission vehicle pledge that was made at COP26. There has been quite a lot of progress around the increase in use of electric vehicles. So that's been a positive. But then you look on the flip side and you look at the power pass coal pledge. And as we all know, actually coal use has gone up in 2022 because many countries have been replacing expensive gas with cheaper coal. So I think it's a very much a mixed bag, but overall, I would say, you know, actually much less progress than people would have hoped for after COP26.
Okay, now, Mikhail, if I can come to you, because one of the major successes of COP26 was the US-China agreement to discuss environmental issues during 2022. Now, of course, Jim has just mentioned the visit of Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan and potential impacts on that. So perhaps you could tell us, you know, what has happened on those relations since Glasgow last year?
I mean, interestingly or not interestingly, not much has happened on the US-China pledge. But if we take a step back, I think the fact that the US-China agreement was seen as such a momentous thing was rather surprising because, again, even though it did inject a huge amount of momentum in the final steps of the talks, there was very little in it. It was very much the US restating its pledges, China restating already announced pledges, and not much new other than a commitment to work together on some issues. So in terms of the bilateral US-China relationship, that was extremely positive. The agreement also talked about joint action on methane. But again, it sort of said that China would come up with its own plan by the end of this year, which it is likely to do. How deep that plan goes and how significant it is in addressing methane emissions is another question. But you know, it provided a little bit of momentum, but not a huge push for China to become more ambitious or for the US to become more ambitious. Again, both sides are doing what they think is right and have become more ambitious in their actions, which is a good thing. But again, it's not a bilateral thing. The pledge committed to working groups, which have not been established. Now, that is partly because it has been very difficult to get into China because of zero COVID and all the logistical constraints around that. US-China relations have soured, and obviously Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in August was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, following which China called off talks with the US. Now, you could be cynical and say that cancelling these talks was actually a face-saving way, rather than saying that nothing has happened and they haven't managed to make any progress on the bilateral issues that were agreed upon in COP26. Of course, bilateral talks are better than no talks, than no conversation. But really, the commitments are still there.
So with that in mind, Michal, you know, is China actually going to take COP27 seriously? You know, what indications, you know, for example, did we get from the recent 20th Party Congress about its environmental goals?
You know, David, I think it's surprising or astounding or a reflection of how China is portrayed in Western media that we are still asking whether China is taking this seriously. Now, China remains committed to its low carbon energy transition. COP27, I think, is the diplomatic or international angle of that, and arguably a smaller part of the China energy transition story. I would argue that China will find it very hard to win diplomatically or rhetorically at COP27, because the focus will be on the increases of approvals of coal-fired power plants in China, the cancellation of the talks with the US, the likely absence of President Xi there. But given the state of debate about China and the polarization of views on China in the West, China cannot win from, again, a public perception perspective. China is taking the transition extremely seriously. It is the largest deployer and manufacturer of renewables in the world. It is on track to exceeding its own renewable deployment targets by 2030 and even faster than 2030. 20th Party Congress statements do reiterate China's commitment to the transition, to its 2030 target, to its 30-60 targets, so to peak emissions by 2030, to reach net zero by 2060. It also does highlight the importance of coal. So it is a mixed bag, but China's position has been a bit of a mixed bag, which is where the debate needs to reflect those complexities. I think what is slightly more worrying is that the Party Congress report talks about the challenging international environment. Previously, China talked about a period of strategic opportunity and an international environment that was conducive to China's development. Now it focuses much more on the hostile environment and the extent to which China is open to collaboration. Now, China does say that it is still open to multilateral efforts, but we are seeing a securitization of everything, again, both in China and in the West. And there is, I think, an open question, is climate a cause for collaboration and a positive deliverable for China and the US and the EU? Or has it become a source of competitive tension? Obviously, it's a bit of both, but are we tilting towards an issue of national security and competitive tension, and that could overweigh the positive outcomes of potential collaboration?
But do you think, you know, China is going to try to take a position itself as the leader of the global South? And, you know, if they do, what are the implications of that?
If there is a more positive story, I guess, PR story for China, it is on the global South. It is certainly a leader of the G77, as it is known. It's championed common but differentiated responsibilities, right, in this whole issue that developing countries cannot bear the entire burden of cleaning up the mess that developed countries have gotten this world into, so to speak. But obviously, its own position as a developing country is somewhat ambiguous. And island nations have been speaking up against China and have been very resentful of the fact that Chinese emissions are endangering their very existence, right, with the rise of sea levels. So it's not all rosy, even within the G77. But clearly, having China leading the cause of the global South is a good thing. There's a very powerful advocate for the global South. But it's also ambiguous, I think, because China is a big seller of technology. So when we talk about $100 billion of funding, of financing that needs to go to the global South, China has attracted some of that funding itself. But it is unlikely to provide funding or public funding. It can provide it on very commercial terms. And China does export a huge amount of renewables and clean tech. In 2022, it's seems to be on track to exporting $100 billion in renewable energy technology, so solar PVs, wind turbines, energy storage equipment. So as a commercial prospect, clearly China is going to capitalize on this. But again, is that how a developing nation interacts with its peers? The money is there, the ability and the technology is there. I think the other thing to look out for are sort of investments on the Belt and Road Initiative, which sort of have been this flagship outbound investment program from China. They have already shifted from coal to renewables, Part of that is following Xi Jinping's pledge not to invest in overseas coal anymore. Part of that was just a slowdown in investments in the aftermath of COVID. And I think as China's economy slows, or economic growth slows, and the available funding for outbound investments that haven't always been the most efficiently executed, those will decrease. And so China's involvement globally will change. It also depends on how much host countries will push for cleaner investments rather than coal. Because again, China has the capability, it has the knowledge and the technologies. But when all things are said and done, China's slow economic growth and reduced availability of funding does suggest that it will invest less overseas. And again, from a Western perspective, we have to think about what is it that we want China to do? Because China has enabled the scale up and the deployment of a huge amount of energy transition related technologies, both within China and globally. If China is now seen as a competitive threat and those investments are undermined, that does raise questions about the speed with which we can introduce the low carbon energy transition.
Now, you mentioned, you know, the large emissions coming from China and kind of some countries' perspective on that. I expect, you know, will China have any credibility at COP27 as it is by far the world's largest emitter? And at the moment, there just seems to be no sign that these emissions or the pace of the emissions are going to be reversed.
Credibility is in the eye of the beholder, I guess. I mean, there are two sides to every story. Obviously, China being the largest consumer of coal, the largest global emitter, is a problem. And there are no solutions to climate change without China and without China changing its emissions footprint. I think it is interesting, though, that even though Chinese emissions increased by 5 or almost 6% year on year last year, they have been falling this year. That is because of the economic slowdown. And so a lot really depends on China's economic trajectory. If the economy continues to weaken, then obviously an industrial activity slows, then there's less coal consumption and there are reduced emissions. Now, we want Chinese emissions to fall because of efficiency gains, because of investments in greener supplies, rather than because the economy is not doing very, very well. But the credibility question is hugely problematic, and China will have to peak emissions before 2030. Now, it's on track to do that. Can it peak closer to 2026, 2027? Or will it be closer to 2030? I think will be a very open question. If it can peak sooner, then obviously that will be a huge boost for its credibility.
If I can move to technology for a minute, Mikhail, because in previous podcasts, we've talked about the importance of technology in the strategy of China's economic growth. So what do you think the impact will be of the recent US decisions to ban semiconductors to China? And do you think that's going to have an effect on China's ability to develop technology for the energy transition? And, you know, what reaction do you think we're going to expect from China?
Hugely negative, I think, overall. I mean, the dust has barely settled on that announcement. And because the ban was issued just before the 20th Party Congress, the Chinese leadership has not yet had any sort of time, I think, to think it through and come up with a response. But it's hard to see what China can do other than reiterate the need to increase its self-sufficiency, to enhance its domestic capabilities. And those are things that the Chinese leadership have been talking about for years. This is to a certain degree a vindication of the fact that the US, or a perception that the US would like to contain China's rise and stop its economic growth. This is hugely problematic. Now, you can discuss it from a national security perspective from the US and from questions of commercial competitiveness and advantages that are being lost to China. But from an energy transition point of view, this is likely to slow it down. It's likely to slow down Chinese innovation. It's likely to slow down Chinese ability to deploy new technologies. And therefore, there is a huge risk of it slowing the global energy transition. I think, again, as I said earlier, there's a securitization of everything. And now energy and climate are also parts of national security around the world. And while there is a clear need to diversify sources of everything, right, of new materials, of batteries, of supply chains, as we've seen here in Europe, diversification is a key contributor to energy security. We need diversification, but we don't necessarily need exclusion of China from all these supply chains, at least not now.
Okay, let's now move our discussion westwards and talk about North America and the EU. Jim, can I come to you? You know, does the US have any credibility, do you think, with delegates at the COP? You know, has it fulfilled its promises and has it become an environmental leader?
So I think its position has changed dramatically since the Biden presidency started. I mean, President Trump had removed the US from the Paris Agreement, and one of the first acts that President Biden did when he arrived in power was to rejoin. And so at COP26, as I mentioned, John Kerry, the US representative, senior representative, made his presence felt significantly and was part of lots of discussions. I think post COP26, there had been a sense that the US was not really kind of coming through in a practical sense and not really implementing policies until the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. So President Biden had been struggling to pass environmental legislation around his Build Back Better policies post-COVID and had been struggling to get environmental legislation through Congress. But the passing of this IRA has really been a major milestone in environmental support. We've seen $360 billion of incentives, either tax incentives or direct support for clean energy technology. And so now I think the US can come to COP27 really with a statement of intent that they are putting their money where their mouth is now. They are actively trying to promote the energy transition, that they are actively trying to move forward with decarbonization and, importantly, encouraging the development of technologies that are going to not only, you know, help the US reduce emissions, but potentially can be you know, applied in the rest of the world. So I think they come with significantly more credibility. There are some criticisms still. I mean, particularly around financing for the developing world, a topic I mentioned earlier. I mean, the US and, to be fair, the EU have also have been part of a coalition blocking some of the measures, particularly around loss and damage, that have been that the developing countries have been wanting to discuss. And so there's some criticism there. There's also concern that the US domestic agenda, particularly around the midterm and forthcoming presidential elections, midterms coming up in November 2022 and the presidential elections in 2024, that there might, you know, there could be another flip in US environmental strategy and policy if we get a Republican, for example, takeover of both houses or a Republican president. So I think there's then that concern around domestic US politics. But as far as COP27 immediately, yes, they do come with more credibility as a result of the passing of this Inflation Reduction Act.
So, Jim, staying with you, you know, focusing on Europe for a minute, you know, do you think that the EU still positions itself as a champion of the energy transition, or, you know, has the war in Ukraine completely distracted it?
Well, the war in Ukraine has obviously been a distraction, and it's been a political distraction and an economic distraction. But the response of the European Commission and others, of course, has been to say that actually accelerating the energy transition is one way of enhancing energy security, of allowing Europe to move away from Russian hydrocarbons, particularly gas. So in that sense, you know, at least there's talk of continued momentum for the energy transition, at least in the medium term. Unfortunately, in the short term, of course, that's not what's happened. In Europe, we've seen the desperate attempts to replace the large amount of Russian gas that has been removed from the market. And that inevitably has meant using more coal. And that's been picked up on by other regions of the world that have kind of been slightly annoyed at Europe's, I guess, somewhat holier-than-thou stance on the transition as positioning itself as a leader. And they have immediately said, well, hold on, at the first sign of trouble, you've immediately flipped black to coal, despite the fact you're telling the rest of the world that coal should not be part of any energy economies. And so, you know, how can you come and tell us about energy transition if this is the way you react when you have something of a crisis? So I think, unfortunately, the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war, despite the fact that, of course, it's exceptional circumstances, and you know, Europe would argue this is a one-off, you know, short-term reaction, we're still on track for transition overall. You know, nevertheless, that has been picked up on by those who wish to be critical of the European stance. I think the other thing to say is, unfortunately, I think despite best intentions, Europe's not really on track to meet its 2030 targets. I think that doesn't mean it won't be on track to meet its 2050 targets. It just means that in the short to medium term, Europe's got quite a lot of work to do to catch up. And again, so in terms of credibility, being behind in terms of meeting your short to medium term targets is not helpful when you're going into environmental negotiations with those you're trying to encourage to speed up.
Okay, so let's close up by asking perhaps the fundamental question, you know, what hope is there for COP27 to be seen as a success? So, Mika, why don't I start with you, perhaps asking you that question from a China and an Asian perspective?
I mean, from a slightly cynical point of view and a lowest common denominator, there could be unity amongst the G77 just in terms of criticism of the EU in response to what Jim was just talking about, that the EU is not on track and the EU is not setting a good example. That's not, again, good for COP27. If we're talking about the theatrics of it, then this could be a positive in China. But I think more seriously, that there would be unity among G77 and actually some kind of action plan as to how to move forward with constructive ideas on the funding gap, on you know, damage and losses. China has focused a lot on biodiversity, and that could be something that comes out with some stronger leadership. There's been a bigger focus on extreme weather events and how to prevent those, how to deal with adaptation. So again, those might be on the G77 and the Global South under China's leadership could be positive outcomes. And I guess if we're looking for slim pickings, if we even get some kind of photo op with Xie Zhenhua and John Kerry with the Chinese and obviously US negotiators, that would be a good thing.
So, Jim, perhaps I can come to you. You know, can you give us your perspective from, you know, Europe and the rest of the world?
So I think two things to say, just to wrap up. Firstly, expectations are so low that even any positive outcome at all will be seen as a success, because I think the general expectation is that this is going to be a very difficult COP for all sorts of geopolitical and economic reasons. The second point I'd make is, if this COP is not a success, that's not necessarily a bad outcome for the world. It may be that the time has come for us to have an unsuccessful COP as a wake-up call for the world that things are not on target and that we really need to take some serious action from here, because if we don't, then essentially the COP process could collapse. So actually, a disappointing COP may not ultimately be a bad thing, even if in the short term it means that you know, the Egyptians are not able to present COP27 as a success.
Well, Mikael and Jim, thank you so much for your time today. You know, I really enjoyed our conversation and indeed the whole of the COP27 podcast series that we've published during October 2022. And of course, if you've missed any of these podcasts, then they're available on the OIS website. Also, several of the interviews were the authors of the Oxford Energy Forum publication 33, that's COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda, that was published in October. And this publication is also available on our website. Now, we will be attending and following the COP27 conference very closely, and our messages will be reflected in future publications and podcasts. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.